call the Senate Transportation Committee meeting to order. It is, what is it, I need a microphone.
It is 1:43 p.m. Today is Thursday, was it March 4th, I believe? Yep.
Yes.
And present at the moment are Vice Chair Schauer, Senator Keel, and myself, Chairman Myers. We have a quorum to do business. Staff committee for the committee today is Nancy Hemingway from Senate Records and Alex Banizek as our moderator and Michaela Anderson as my committee aides. I should know that one. Just the quick reminder to please silence your cell phones. So two items on the agenda today. We're going to be starting off with a presentation from the Department of Administration on the DMV closures and transitions. Presenting online are Commissioner Chewbacca and the Division of Motor Vehicles Director, Jeffrey Schmitz. I believe we also have, Kelly Hanke, the ledge liaison on board, in case we need to call on her. After the overview, we'll be hearing the governor's appointees for the Border Marine Pilots. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Chewbacca. Go ahead and please identify yourself for the record and take it away. Please pause in between each slide if you can, in case we have any questions.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for having us today. I'm Kelly Chewbacca, Commissioner of the Department of Administration. And with me is Jeffrey Schmitz. Jeff, could you please put yourself on the record?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, this is Jeffrey Schmitz. I'm the DMV director for the state of Alaska.
We're here to brief you today on our budget proposals to transition six separate DMV offices to public-private partnerships. We'll go to slide two to fill you in on the details of these proposals. On slide two, these public-private partnerships will provide stability and efficiency for DMV processes across Alaska. Our state has a long history of successful partnerships, such as these private sector businesses, to improve services for Alaskans. Our public-private partnerships allow us to share cost burdens with private sector partners, create more local jobs, improve access, and provide faster service for Alaskans who must visit a DMV in person. DMV will be able to reduce leasing and overhead expenses and also give more funds back to the general fund, which helps us address budget concerns, while also allowing for private businesses to develop and grow in communities. We will not be diminishing any state revenues when we transition to these public-private partnerships, because most of these transactions are done online and processed by DMV employees. Also, when our private business partners do these transactions, we still retain the cost of the fee for the DMV transaction. We also want to emphasize that no DMV jobs will be lost during this transition. We intend to keep our DMV employees still hired with the DMV. We're only vacant PCNs.
Any questions so far?
Next slide. This is how the in-person DMV transactions work. There are only five primary reasons why an Alaskan needs to still visit the DMV, because our DMV staff has done a fantastic job of digitizing so many of our services for the DMV. So those reasons happen once in a lifetime, once a decade, or maybe once every two decades. They are your original driver's license or ID issuance, like when you're 16, your second driver's license renewal by statute every 15 to 16 years, you have to come in and get it in person. Senior citizen driver's license renewal happens every 8 years. That's also by statute. The DMV doesn't yet have an online solution for these two things, driver's license reinstatement and knowledge testing. Those are the five primary reasons people to come in. We've counted with our data that about 95% of our DMV transactions can be completed entirely online, And like Jeff likes to remind me, or by the mail. We've been able to do a lot of our DMV transactions remotely.
I got a question on that. The 95% of transactions, is that 95% by type or is it 95% by volume?
So through the chair, the answer to that is 95% by volume. When we look at all transactions across all offices, 95% of the transactions we are doing could be done online.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in the spans of time here that are given. I mean, if we took a typical household say mine, and looked at the need to renew a driver's license and take two teenagers through their learner's permit tests and then their driver's license issuance, and it ends up, I think, being, you know, let's see, two, four, half a dozen trips in 4 years instead of one every 15 to 16 years. So I'm interested in these frequency numbers and the impression they give.
Okay. And what the one thing that, Commissioner, the one thing I do notice up there that's not up there that you can't do online that I'm concerned about is anything dealing with commercial vehicles. For example, I have a CDL and I can't renew that online, nor can I renew it through a one of the private companies such as UMV. So that just one example of another thing that is not done online that does happen, and in my case it's every 5 years. So it's a little bit more concerning for me personally. And I know I'm not the only one. But. Any other questions?
Did she have any comments to his?
Senator Keel, were you expecting a response to that or just making a comment?
It was just a comment, Mr. Chairman, but always open.
All righty. All right. Please proceed.
Well, through the chair, since Senator Keel is always open, the power to change statutes is in the hands of the respectable people at the bench right now. And the statute about second driver's license renewal for seniors and for non-seniors could be changed so that that could be done through the mail or online with a doctor's note saying that they have the eyesight required to be safe on the roads, if you wanted to consider that. It would be two less reasons why Alaskans have to come to a DMV in person.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So with that, Kelly, this might be more directed at Jeff. What data does the state have in its database and studies or whatever else you have compiled and collected that would indicate that is that first of all these numbers are kind of historical, just how we ended up here? Are there things that they would go, no, you wouldn't want to do that based on this information, how many people fail test, have physical issues or other things? In other words, if you look at the numbers, are these things that we could extend? Could they be, you know, hopefully not shorter, but are they things possible with where we sit today that they could be extended even further? And I understand the legislative part of that as an answer as well, and other proposals would certainly be, I'm open to that, because any way that we can help people be more efficient and spend less time having to deal with the government bureaucracy in a building is certainly a positive step forward. In a lot of ways. So could either one of you maybe answer that? First of all, that first part about data that you've compiled, and secondly, or maybe for online, Mr. Chairman, you know, provide us that information, ideas that we might introduce legislatively to change. And one more thing, Commissioner, just so I don't get it wrong, do these have to be statutory changes, or can some of these be regulatory policy changes by the administration versus statutory? Thank you. I know it's a lot of questions. I can repeat them if needed. Sorry. About that in the way.
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, the requirement to come in for a second driver license renewal and a senior citizen driver license renewal are in statute. And I'll turn it over to our DMV director to answer the question about data if he has that readily available.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. With respect to data, DMV tracks all sorts of data in terms of what our customer trends are. And we have shown over the last 3 years that more and more Alaskans are, in fact, utilizing online services and the ability to be able to do their DMV work via mail and electronically. So that is a trend that's continuing to trend upwards. Certainly during the pandemic, during the last year, that's even been emphasized even more, showing that there is a demand and a desire for, attempting to do transactions online for many people, for the first time. So in 2020, for example, record numbers in terms of our online and via mail transaction processing versus having to come into an office in person. So that is a trend that is trending upwards and is one of the reasons why we feel it to be a compelling reason to bring before the committee today to, try to project where this is going and what the demand and what the service desires are of citizens wanting to do their transactions safely and efficiently via our electronic options.
Follow-up, Senator Sauer.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So just two things to that. One, and you don't necessarily have to answer them now. I would be curious if you had information that would show us, for example, let's say you could do every 9 years or every 10 years for seniors. And maybe the data doesn't bear that out, but if you had information or proposals on that, I think that might be important because every year you extend that, it's just less time that people have to spend, going through the bureaucratic nightmare sometimes, and I say that because we've all got our DMV stories, right? I mean, I'm a little bit of a joke there. But, everybody would certainly love to be able to do things online and not have to go wait in line and get your number on any, entity, of course. And then the second thing is if you have statutory ideas, proposals, I would be interested to hear those back from you as well on what the commissioner just mentioned. On, for example, going, hey, we can go to, allowing seniors to do this online or whatever those proposals might be. And I mean, Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested in looking at legislative proposals that are going to make life more efficient for folks because we don't want to make it harder for them. We want to make it easier. So I hadn't thought about that until now. So if there's information we could get offline or further discussion, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Actually, to follow up on Director Schmitz's comments, I would be very interested in the data in terms of how Alaskans are choosing to access DMV. It's interesting to read that 95% of transactions could be completed online. Pre-pandemic, I think, because we have a real exception year here, but I'd be interested in seeing the 3 years pre-pandemic, what percentage of transactions Alaskans are choosing to complete online. Are we talking about what people want?
Fair enough point.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Sauer?
With Senator Keel and your question is that, in addition to that, what would be fascinating to know is, do they know? Because if they don't know, then they won't use it, right? I think most people still think they have to go to DMV, and if that's something we're lacking on information, then perhaps we want to look at how we would educate the public and get that information out, mailers or, whatever the appropriate method is. But clearly, if people don't know that service is available to them, they probably would still go like we all did in the old days, go to DMV. So if that is something that it was a lower percentage, but now they understand it's there, we could probably help with that, I would think. Just comment.
Fair enough. All right, Commissioner, I think we're good for now. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. We'll move to slide 4. We wanted to provide you the answer to the question, if we transition these DMVs to public-private partnership, what is the cost of doing service with the private partners? Because the way a private partner runs is they offer the DMV services, but they offer a service charge on top of them. That's how they stay in business as a private business. So on the left-hand side is the transaction type, some of your more common transactions at the DMV. In the middle column is how much it costs to get those things done at a state-run DMV.
Could you?
And then on the right-hand side is one of our largest partners or one of our largest private partners. If you go in person to their office, this is how much it costs to get that same transaction done. So we wanted to give this to you as an example of a private partner cost. We also wanted to note though, that private partner costs vary. And so depending on the private partner that sets up business in one of these locations, this would not necessarily be the cost of that transaction.
Commissioner, we seem to be missing that slide here. We don't have it projected, nor was it part of the presentation that we were given.
Could you ask her what slide she's working off?
What slide are you working off of?
I am working off of this slide. Can you see it now?
Yep, we don't have that.
Yeah, we don't have that one.
We will send this to you.
Okay, thank you. If you could leave that there for just a second till we can examine quickly.
She can, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, she could just talk through that again while we can see it now.
Since we can see it, can you go ahead and my apologies, could you please repeat what you said earlier?
Yes, I can. Can you see the chart okay, or do you need me to talk through the different costs?
I think we're in good shape.
Okay. So what this slide shows is we're often asked, well, what would be the difference in cost if we were to transition a location to a public-private partnership? Because the private partners will often, with how they work is they provide the DMV service, but they provide it with a service charge because that's how they stay in business. So on the left-hand side is the transaction type, something that's pretty common at a DMV. In the middle is how much we charge at a state-run DMV. And then on the right-hand side is what you would be charged at one of our larger private partners. So this UMV is common in a lot of cities around Alaska. But this is just an example of a private partner cost. In several of these cities that we're talking to, it would not be UMV that opens, and private partners have the freedom to charge their own prices. And so, for example, across the top, a registration renewal costs about $110 plus taxes at a state-run DMV. At UMV, it costs about $132 plus taxes. And so as you read down, you see the difference in the prices between state-run and a private partner DMV.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, I'm looking at that, and obviously, you know, I had some documentation sent to us by an individual that had different, I'm trying to look for the right word here, different thoughts on this process that was not positive. And one of the things that I had a question on were cost. And so we're discussing that here, which is good. I see some of those that are fairly significant, you know, like registration duplicates. I mean, that's significantly over what it costs a person now, you know, parking placards. I don't have to read through it all, but, you know, driver's license ID, you know, that's more than double potentially, and I understand that there would be some varying costs here. I see your note. That was one of the concerns addressed, is that for especially those that are older or on fixed incomes, disability, et cetera, you know, that's, and I understand as well that this is not an often thing. They only do this every, you know, X number of years, but that is some fairly significant cost increases over what they pay for a state-run service. So that's more of a comment than a question, but we'll have to think about that, obviously. But the question part I do have is, looking at that fee, the government in this public-private partnership, what portion of that are we going to get to stay cost-neutral or revenue-positive as it currently is for the state over that number? In other words, is the state going to keep what it normally would, and then those fees are just additive to that, which of course, and it's going to, I'll just say it, it's going to get, you know, added to the consumer. So can you just illuminate that a little bit more?
Yes. So through the chair, Senator Schauer, I have a comment and an answer. So to the first concern, which I also take very seriously, we're all in this really challenging time of having to span a $2 billion budget gap. And so this is a creative proposal from our department to try to do that without significantly changing services to Alaskans. When you look at this list, all of this can be done through the mail or online, except for Real ID, which isn't required to get through TSA. People can use passports, military ID, tribal ID, VA ID, except for that driver license ID that's a second renewal. And again, it's up to you all if you want to change that statute. And then all of this could be done through the mail or online, and everybody would get the prices in the middle column. So that's one response to the comment and concern. In response to your question, the state would retain all of the revenue that's in that middle column, and the private business retains the delta between the middle column and the right-hand column. So the state isn't going to lose any revenue by transitioning to a public-private partnership.
Yeah, Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, I guess this it raises the structural question. I mean, what do we see? What is the purpose of the DMV? Not the mission statement, but Commissioner, what's the DMV for?
So, do you mind if I close this out, Senator Keel?
Sure.
Okay, so through the chair, Senator Keel, our purpose is to provide customer service to Alaskans that keep our roads safe. We keep Alaska moving, essentially, and do so in a way that is a customer service interface to Alaskans. One of the ways that we do that is through our public-private partnerships.
Senator Keel?
Mr. Chairman, I guess respectfully, I disagree a little bit. I think those are important tools to serve the mission, but ultimately I believe the DMV is a government regulatory agency. It exists to register vehicles and prove ownership. It exists to test the knowledge and skills of drivers on the road, and provide certain other public safety functions. And of course, the things that the commissioner mentioned, Mr. Chairman, are essential to do that well and to do that right. But ultimately, I am trying to find the governmental purpose in the revenue function that we're discussing here, a revenue function beyond covering the cost of the service, because we require a lot of our regulatory agencies to do that. That's appropriate. And while I certainly support private businesses, I'm trying to find the role of a regulatory agency in creating private businesses where there were none before in the regulatory function. I'm having trouble, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Commissioner, if you have a response to that,
yes.
You're welcome to.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So, Senator Keel, we're not seeing our role as creating businesses. We've been partnering with public-private partnerships going back 40 years or more. Some of these public-private partnerships date back into the 1980s. This is a long-standing practice here in Alaska, given the unique challenges that we have with our size of state, with some of the needs of our communities, and the role of the DMV in serving these needs. I agree with you, and as I said, our role is to keep our roads safe, keep Alaskans safe. You describe it as a regulatory function. We think of it as a safety function. DMV used to be in the Department of Public Safety for a really long time. The ways that we do that are increasingly creative and innovative. Like we've talked about, moving a lot of these transactions onto online. There is a large infrastructure that goes into making DMV happen. And part of that infrastructure, we have a lot of partners. Part of that infrastructure is our business partners. What we're putting before you are some further proposals of how we can leverage business partners to continue to achieve mission while also reducing costs.
All righty. Feel free to continue. Hold up. Senator Schauer?
Sorry about that, Commissioner. It's probably kind of here talking about it, but a question I do have is kind of a cost comparison. If you can talk to it briefly, that's great. Between having the public-private partnerships, if the state's doing the service, and just pick one, you know, Delta Junction, only because you have some data, because they're already doing this apparently, and of course I'm interested in that one since it's in my district, and the public-private partnership company doing the service, is it essentially the same cost as it is now? So what's the cost comparison for the data that you do have or project for the other entities that would be picking this up for the same services?
Thank you.
So through the chair, Senator Schauer, I don't have that data right with me, so let's get that back to you.
Thank you.
Commissioner, thank you. Please continue.
Does your next slide say status of transitions?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So this is where we're at in our status of conversations. In Delta Junction, we already have a private partner set up in operation with the DMV. In TOC, the private partner in Delta Junction is willing to operate a private partner operation in TOC as well. In Homer, we're very far along in discussions with a private partner who is willing to set up there. And same thing in Eagle River, we're very close to signing a contract with a private partner in that community as well. In Valdez, we're in active discussions with private partners, and in Haines, we're actively recruiting qualified private partners. So that's the status of our discussions with private partners for transition.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it's kind of Commissioner was alluding to before with Delta Junction, since it's already in operation. How long have they been in operation? Have they been in operation? What feedback do you have so far from, if you have any? And I understand if some of this is not at your fingertips, we can certainly, I'd be happy to get that back from the department on how it's going, feedback from the public. Are they happy with it, unhappy? You know, any kind of data that kind of tells us from what you have from ones already operating, and of course that helps us know a little bit more about what we're getting into with this. I think that would be helpful. But if there's anything top level that you can kind of tell us about the ones already operating and how it's gone, I would be interested to hear that now to the committee. Because like I said, two of the six on here are in my district, and as you're well aware, you know, we're getting some negative feedback so far from some groups on this and what it may do. Maybe it's the right answer, but I just want to get a better feel for it. Thank you.
I'll defer this one to Jeff.
Mr. Chair, committee members, with respect to your question about the private office in Delta Junction, that is a relatively new office that just opened in December of 2020. In terms of feedback, we have not heard anything negative, and certainly our customers are pretty open with letting us know how things are going. So I would say that things are going well with the new operation in Delta Junction in terms of feedback, and a relatively new operation just in its first quarter of operation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just a couple of quick questions on this. So I want to be clear on this for the record, because it's some of the information I'm getting from constituents. I think it could be misinformation, but I want to make sure it's correct on at least what we're considering. Some of the information we're getting is, why are we shutting down? And this, I'm going to go to the specific two of my district, because those are the ones I have to contend with here for Delta Junction and Valdez. Is like, why is the administration shutting down these locations? So that's one thing I would like to just have you discuss, because it appears that we're not shutting them down, but we're transitioning to something different, a different model on those locations. And then just a few of the other I don't want to say misrepresentations, because I need you to tell me if they are or not, but I'm hearing things like, well, if we shut them down, you know, then I have to drive 6 hours to get to the nearest one, et cetera. And are there any other locations that we are that you're considering doing this to in the future, or that you're actually shutting down, which are increasing the drive time and, you know, the hassle that Alaskans are going to go through to have these services that are have to be in person if they do that? So I know that, again, a couple questions, Mr. Chairman, but these are questions, Commissioner, I'm getting now over the last few months, and I have reached out to you previously when I was getting those, because I'm like, where is this coming from? I hadn't even heard of it. So if you could maybe talk about that for just a moment or two, I'd appreciate it.
I appreciate the question. Through the chair, Senator Schauer, we are intending to transition all of these locations. We're being upfront and straightforward with you about the status of the negotiations with our private business partners and where we are at with them. Unfortunately, we can't share which private business partners we are talking to because of the nature of our contract negotiations, but this slide tells you where we're at in that process. We are not intending to transition or close any other DMV offices at this time. If we were, we would have to bring that to you.
Just to be clear.
Yep, Senator Sharp.
Thank you. Just to be clear, there are no locations that we are not being informed of that are actually being shut down. Those that are on the list or have been considered, they're only being transitioned, not shut down. Is that correct? Because that's feedback I'm getting. So I want to be crystal clear on that. Is every DMV office that's operating or location going to continue to operate, whether it's run by the state or run by a private partner. That is, and I apologize, I don't mean to kind of kick the dead horse here, but I just want to be crystal clear on the record. Nothing is shutting down. It's only transitioning. Is that correct?
Through the chair, we only have the power to operate or not operate DMVs. What we are doing is actively working to transition these offices by having private business partners open up. So we can either open offices or not open offices. We can't force a private business partner to open an office somewhere. What we can do, and this is, I'm not sure if this is covered in a slide later, what we can do is be strategic in choosing the locations that we propose for closure, because we know that they are lucrative areas that will be attractive to a private business partner. That's part of the reason we've selected these locations. And so we knew, for example, if we targeted these areas, we would have a much higher likelihood of success with some of our private business partners of saying, would you please move into these areas and serve these clients, because this is something we would like to have happen for Alaskans. That's why I think we've been so successful in getting very close to having these contracts done at this point in time. We obviously, because this runs on a budget cycle or even on a lease cycle, some of these leases aren't going to be up until the fall. We have some time before we need to actually have these contracts done. But I want to be clear that we don't have the power to say a business partner has to open up. We take from you whether a office is open or closed. Right now, this is how far we are in these discussions, and we are actively working and recruiting to open partners in all these areas. That is our plan and intent.
Senator Schauer.
Two more, and I'll try to be done, Commissioner. I just want to drill down on this because, again, it's become kind of a contentious issue a little bit, at least in those two towns where this is proposed inside of the district I represent. So it's not necessarily, and we're parsing words here, I know, and I'm not trying to poke. I'm just trying to get it right for the record and the things that I'm hearing. It's not necessarily incorrect to say we are shutting down DMV offices in these areas or have, but we are also hoping to open a public-private partnership with other vendors that would provide those services. So I guess maybe that's where some of the technical things and people are hearing. I just want to clear that up, that we are shutting them down, but you're trying to open other things up. And then the second part of that would be, is there a plan B if we shut an office down and the vendor falls through or doesn't work or something happens? What is the plan B for providing those services?
Through the chair, technically we would be closing state offices and transitioning to a private business in that area like we have in many other parts of the state, with the exception that Delta Junction already has a private business open and the Delta Junction office is ready to move into TOC and provide private business services there. If something were to fall through in one of these areas, We already have people that we've called. We've got a couple different leads in each of these towns, and we would move into recruiting the next person on the list. That would be the plan.
One last follow-up, I swear.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know I'm holding off Senator Keel at a question, too. Last question, I promise, at least on this slide, Commissioner, is if the vendors, and I just want to drill down to the bottom on this so I have answers if people ask, if you go through, you had three vendors and they all fall out, something was to happen, whatever, what, besides having to drive, either do business online or if they had to go in person, drive to the next nearest one, which for some of these is pretty far, I guess Valdez would really be the issue for my particular district. Are there any options to reopen a DMV if this doesn't work, or is that too cost prohibitive? Once we close it, is it kind of a done deal? If you could just discuss that eventuality, please. And then I promise I'm done on this one. Thank you.
Yes, through the chair. It's not a done deal. We could absolutely come back and have a conversation with the legislature about reopening an office in Valdez, for example, if we weren't able to find a private business partner and we determined the community needs an in-service office, an in-person office that operated in Valdez.
All right. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I got a little lost at one point. The commissioner said that these six were selected because they would be lucrative and a high chance of success for a private partner. It seems to me that these are among our smaller DMVs or among our sort of, actually, I guess they're probably in the mid-range for population served. Wouldn't we have a much higher chance of success if we went to our largest cities, where we had the most volume through? Why wouldn't we, if this is going to be no great inconvenience to Alaskans and among our goals is a high chance of success, why isn't this Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Ketchikan, Bethel?
So through the chair, we have private partners in a lot of our large cities already that operate alongside our established DMVs. And we picked these not only because these are places where we thought we could attract business partners, also because they're on a transportation system that if something were to fall through, like you were saying, Senator Schauer, we would be able to have the ability for residents to get to another DMV. We didn't want to be out in an area that wasn't connected to a hub area where people would have to fly in and it would be very expensive. We also wanted to make sure we were in an area that had a lot of internet connectivity. We didn't want to pick offices that were stranded out in places that didn't have connectivity. And we were also looking at places like when were our leases coming up and expiring, or where were we having locations challenge. And this was time where we needed to turn over a lease. So there was a multi-factor decision-making process that went into it.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Sometimes I'm slow. Mostly what I heard in the response were answers to why didn't we choose smaller towns. But what I'm really hoping to drill into is why we didn't choose our biggest cities. Why we didn't choose places where, you know, certainly Anchorage and Fairbanks have, one could drive to the other. We've got great internet, reliable internet in those places. Plenty of options, but you know, when I read the budget detail, it talks about cutting costs, and when I hear the conversation, we talk about high chance of success for the private partner. So help me understand the reasoning that we've gone to six in the middle instead of the biggest cities. If this is really no great inconvenience to regular Alaskans.
So through the chair, we were also looking at the amount of transactions done, what could be done online, and what could be handled by a business partner versus the amount of volume done in other places. You'll see, for example, that we do have Eagle River on here. That's a pretty significant sized community to what you're talking about. Putting a lot of cities on here, this has been a pretty controversial proposal just in the magnitude that it is. I think it'd be pretty hard if we put a major city on here for anyone to take this as an innovative proposal that it is. If you'd like us to come back and consider something larger, we'd be happy to introduce that to you.
All right. I think we're done with this slide.
Okay. The commercial drivers in TOC, this has been a concern and a question that's come up. So TOC serves as our commercial permitting hub for commercial drivers entering Alaska from Canada. I know that the members on this committee are aware of that, but for those who might be watching and are curious about it, this proposal provides options for those drivers to obtain the proper permits. Drivers who enter TOC and are not able to access our DMV, even though we would have a private partner there, either can continue to Delta Junction or to Glen Allen to check in at the TOC or check in at the TOC way station. We do have permits available at the TOC way station for them. The TOC way station hours, we're still checking on those, so we've been waiting for that information. Commercial truckers can purchase a 30-day temporary registration from DOT online before they enter as well. So those are the solutions for our truckers, Delta Junction, Glen Allen, or the TOC way station.
So what I am concerned about as a commercial driver is that TOC way station, it doesn't close much. About 3 to 4 a.m. is about it. But if I tell the commercial motor vehicle enforcement officer there that my paperwork's out of order and I'm going to have to fix it in Delta or Glen Allen, I got a funny feeling he's going to look at me and say, okay, but here's your fine. Whereas if I say, hey, I can fix it here in TOC, he's going to say, oh, okay, come back in half an hour. So that may change the relationship between the drivers and the
the commercial vehicle enforcement guys. As a general rule, there's exceptions, but the commercial vehicle enforcement in the state usually tries to work with drivers and companies, especially when it comes to something relatively simple like a paperwork registration type issue, not a straight safety issue. And you start putting the DMV a little further away from the commercial motor vehicle enforcement, and they aren't going to be able to check up on you and making sure you're actually doing what you say you're going to be doing. That may change the relationship a little bit less from working with and a little more into a punitive relationship. Do you have a response to that, Commissioner?
I didn't want to be presumptuous and speak. So through the chair, would you say that the DMV is open and the times at the weigh station is closed? Can you explain how that works out in TOG?
So as a what would be possible is if somebody pulled into TOG at, say, 5 in the morning and the weigh station is open, driver can take a nap, go to sleep, wait until 8 or 9 a.m. whenever the DMV happens to open. And quite often, as long as you don't proceed past the scale, the commercial motor vehicle would be enforcement officers would be relatively amenable to what needs to happen, and then whether that means trying to take a tractor over, disconnect, or take try to find another ride over there and back, they're generally somewhat amenable. But if the issue is go to Delta Junction or go to Glen Allen, then that becomes another story.
I understand that. I know that we've started talking with DOT about enforcement on this. That's a coordination point that would need to be considered in this transition.
Okay. All right. One other question. Can we get a list of the types of things that a commercial motor vehicle enforcement officer might be writing a ticket for that normally could be fixed at a DMV and cannot be done online?
Yes, we'll get that information back to you.
Thank you. You had a question? Oh, no, okay, all right. I believe we're done with that slide. Thank you.
On this slide, these are from fiscal year 18 through 20, just a brief snapshot of how most transactions in the DMV are completed. In blue, 57% can always be done online. In green, 38% sometimes are done online. And 5% are the transactions that can only be done in person. For transactions that can be done online or in person, costs are the same to Alaskans. We just wanted to show you this at a high level of how DMV works. But you've asked for more detailed information on this. We'll get back to you on that.
Okay. Don't think there's any questions on that slide.
On this following slide, the proportions of population served, we wanted to provide more detail. This has been requested by legislators on the population in each of the locations, the percentage of Alaska that they represent, the total in-person transactions that occurred at each of those locations, so you could have that data available.
Senator Machicki.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. Couple of questions on the driver license reinstatement and knowledge testing, and then you think of the percentage that could have been done online. Was this ever sort of accessibility tested? So we're looking at the only things that can be done or must be done in person, but we know that there's part of the population that does not have online access. There's a generational thing. There's a just general access thing, and then there's just folks that have chosen not to live their life online, and bless those folks. I wish I was one of them. But I think the numbers that you have in the bottom box of the 83 to 95%, from what I'm looking at here, likely doesn't take that into account. Is that possible?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, one of the things that we are cognizant of is that the people who don't want to do things online can also do them through the mail. And we have an extensive call center to help those Alaskans walk through that process where we can help them figure out how to process these different things through forms and the mail, where we send them a form and they can send it back to us and process transactions through the U.S. Postal Service.
Follow up, Senator Machicki.
So can a senior citizen and homer renew their license, have it reinstated, or have a knowledge test online?
So through the chair, it depends on the age of our wonderful senior citizen. And what we talked about a little bit earlier in the committee is the only thing that's prohibiting us from being able to do that online or through the mail is a statute. And it would be possible for the members of this committee to change that, where we could do that online or through the mail with, for example, a statement from a doctor saying, I verify that this person is legally safe to drive, medically safe to drive on the roads. And so we'll get back to the committee with some information about that. And, oh, I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator Machicki, for the knowledge test, there are some other states that have piloted online knowledge testing. We have talked about ways to do that. What we want to be careful of is people doing open book knowledge tests, and then we make our roads less safe than they are, because they never really learned the material they need to be safe on the roads. So we've talked through some different options of how to do remote knowledge testing while also protecting the safety of Alaska's roads. We've started discussing that.
So, Mr. Chairman, I have a follow-up.
Yeah, Senator Machicki, one more.
So I know we have private options in Soldotna, Alaska. I think we have two private options in Soldotna, but I don't believe that there's a private option in Homer. Was that evaluated if an individual could get service? So let's forget about the online stuff, even if we just take that whole collectively and not think about who doesn't have access or is not comfortable with online access. Did we think about the fact that the miles that folks would have to travel from a place like Homer and maybe some of the other offices, the other members could speak about that, but if there's not a private option for the things that can't be done online, did we evaluate that when we decided that Homer, and I obviously have been contacted by Homer area folks, I'm trying to be responsive to them, but did we evaluate that mileage when we made the closure decisions?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we evaluated multiple factors for these six given locations when we made the proposal. I want to emphasize these are only proposals. These are discussions that we're having with you, and there's not a decision to close these offices independent of the discussions with you. The status of the Homer location is we're very close to finalizing a contract with a private business partner to open a location in Homer. So we're very confident that there will soon be a private business partner DMV service, much like the ones in Soldotna, that will soon open in Homer.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A correction and a request. The numbers on the chart for Haines are off by about 50%. Somebody may have given you the town site instead of the Haynesboro, but if you'll check the Department of Labor and the Census Bureau, you're looking at north of 2,500. The request, though, would be could we see this restated with non-pandemic transaction numbers? I think if I heard Director Schmitz correctly, he talked about how in-person transactions were down pretty significantly in 2020 as people were concerned about the pandemic. So I'm not sure that's the base year to use for our chart here. So, Mr. Chairman, if we could get that with an earlier year that maybe has a more number more reflective of Alaskans when we're not worried.
I've been saying multiple times that 2020 doesn't count. yes, Commissioner Chewbacca, if we could get that information, we'd appreciate it. And then
sounds good.
All right. And then Senator Schauer.
who knew such a short briefing, Commissioner could cause so many questions, right? Just a comment real quick. Same thing that Senator Keel said on Haynes, I would say on Delta. It's actually more probably, if you look at the unorganized, it's actually an unorganized borough. It's probably closer to 4,000. If somebody, and it may or may not be available to you, but I think that would be an interesting one as well, because it's going to show it's a lot higher traffic. I just know Valdez and Delta are kind of 4,000-ish population centers that I deal with. So just something for the chart as an informational purpose. The other one was just brought up as just a quick question. I don't think there are any, but it would be interesting if Jeff might talk to this, if there were any regulatory things for the last year that were dropped or that were canceled that were useful. If there's not, that's great. If there were, I'd like to know what those are, that we, because we're looking at these different things that we have found that might have made things more efficient or useful through the termination is not the right word, but you know, where we suspended certain things. So if there's something that came out of the COVID act here, it would be perhaps useful. I'd like to know what those are if we could get them.
We'll get that to you.
Other questions on this one? All right, so I believe we are at the end of our presentation, unless we missed another slide, but hopefully not. I did have one kind of overarching question as going into the decision-making process here. Rather than closing up shop and turning some of this over to private businesses, did we investigate possibly consolidating operations within different departments? So, for example, I believe all six of these locations all have a trooper station. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong on that, but you mentioned already that the DMV used to be within the Department of Public Safety, and it makes me wonder if we could kind of go back to the future a little bit and consolidate the office and have an employee be paid half time by DOA and half time by DPS, and be able to handle some of these transactions instead of closing up completely. Was that an option that was discussed?
So, Chairman, we did not discuss that option as part of this budget proposal round. That wouldn't actually save the state any money. It would just come from two different departments. I do recall early in my time as commissioner, when we started to think through the alignment of DOA, if you look at DOA's mission, our mission is to support the other departments. But about half the divisions in DOA, including DMV, don't have anything to do with the other state departments. And so we really took a hard look at those divisions and thought about where do we put these divisions, because they don't have anything to do with the statutory mission of DOA. And we did talk with DPS about moving all of DMV over to DPS, and that was a no-go for several reasons. And so we lovingly embrace DMV inside DOA, but that kind of goes to the heart of your question. Where does DMV fit best? And to Senator Keel's comment before, what is the main purpose of DMV? Is it really a support other departments type function? Or is it a public safety type function? We were kind of going to that higher level strategic focus question before, and then where in the budget does it align best? We did not think about that question that you just presented this time around. We were thinking about how can we best still serve Alaskans while also trying to contribute something to the budget dilemma that we're all faced with right now. These are some of our ideas. We have other ideas that you all are seeing in some of your other committees about modernization and digitization of the services that we're doing. These are just proposals that we're putting forward for consideration. The other thing I'd add is please consider them as six different proposals. They're not a all or nothing proposal. There are six different offices, six different communities with six different factors to consider in each place. That's how we look at them as well.
All right. Any other closing questions or comments from anybody? All right. I think we're good. Commissioner, thank you for joining us today. Same thing for Director Schmitz. Thank you. We appreciate that. And hopefully we can get some answers back on a few of the questions we asked relatively soon. But all right. Moving on with the rest of our agenda today, and thank you, Mr. Harris and Mr. Hassenbach, for your for your patience. We will be moving on to the confirmation hearings for the Board of Marine Pilots. I'd like to start with Mr. Richard Harris out of Juneau. If you could please introduce yourself, speak to your background and your qualifications, and just why do you want to be on the Board of Marine Pilots, sir? Please take it away. Oh, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds good.
I live in...
Uh-oh. Mr. Harris, if you could hold on a second here. Oh, we seem to have a little technical difficulty. If you could start over, you were cutting out some.
Okay, how about now?
Yeah, go ahead. Let's try again.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, my name is Richard Harris. I'm known as Rick Harris. I have... I'm coming before the committee for a reappointment to the Board of Marine Pilots. This will be my second term as the public member. I live in Juneau, Alaska. I'm a 43-year resident of Alaska. Some of my biographical information is, first of all, I'm a United States Army veteran from 1968 to 70. I have an honorable discharge with the rank of sergeant from the Army. I have a Bachelor of Science in Fisheries from the University of Washington. I arrived in Alaska in 1978 to work with the Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. There I was a project manager developing some of the initial hatchery and salmon enhancement programs. In 1980, I moved to Sea Alaska Corporation, which is the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act Regional Corporation for Southeast Alaska. And I remained there from 1980 and 2014 when I retired. Within Sea Alaska, I held many positions, environmental manager, vice president, and also senior vice president for natural resources. And then my final position with the company was the executive vice president until my retirement. I have extensive experience in natural resource management, public policy development. Examples would be like state and federal laws and regulations, development of those, also budgeting, revenue, expense management, and then, of course, the corporate profit and loss obligations. As a Board of Marine Pilot public member, I'm not a Marine pilot, but I do have extensive knowledge of the Marine pilot requirements. And as a senior executive at Sea Alaska, we used considerable ship charter business, and marine pilots were a vital part of our service or being able to ship logs from Southeast Alaska to other markets throughout the world. So I have a great deal of knowledge and experience of what marine pilots do and their importance. From a perspective on the board, I bring an understanding of the role of marine pilots and their role in facilitating commerce, also their role in safe passage of cargo and cruise vessels, and their role in protecting the environment, in other words, to ensure that we have safe passage without accidents from vessels. My family also worked in the cruise industry, so I also have extensive knowledge of the cruise ships and, again, their navigation and the importance of pilots. In conclusion, I bring to a public voice to assure Alaska residents of the rigorous control and safe passage of vessels throughout Southeast Alaska waters. I bring to the board knowledge of the public concerns about safe passage of vessels and how to address those concerns. And my public policy experience benefits the board in regulatory and budget compliance or budget issues. So I can go on, but I'm sure you're busy, so I'm happy to answer any questions.
All righty. Any questions from anybody on the committee? Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any issues with Mr. Harris, and I've heard only positive things, which is what I'd expect. If it's all right with you, I'd love to get his perspective on whether there are things that the legislature should know about the board, the industry, or whether there are issues we should be trying to get ahead of as an Alaska legislature. We have the time, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we got a little bit of time, Mr. Harris, if you could give us the 10,000-foot view if you have a response to that.
I'll give you a very short one. Yes, Mr. Chairman, probably, ironically, one of the greatest challenges is Marine pilots have to pay for their own training, and so they, until they actually have a pilot's license and are able to be pilots on ships, they do not have the ability. I mean, it's all coming out of their pocket. And one of the things that they've historically been able to do is to ride the ferries and to get a fairly inexpensive or free stateroom on a needs on available basis, which gave them experience into a variety of ports, which they don't get with necessarily cargo ships or cruise ships. And the ferry system has reduced or, in fact, I think terminated those benefits or privileges to people who are pilot training. I would certainly hope that in the time in the future, questions can be asked about that in order to see if we can't make it a little easier for these guys to get their license. And there are other things we can go into, but frankly, I think we've gone through, we've done some regulation changes, we've done a few statutory changes, and this is my second term on the board, I feel fairly comfortable that we've got things under control. We're all suffering from COVID, and the lack of work for the pilots, but people are sticking with it, and we will have plenty of pilots available to charter vessel or to supervise the navigation of vessels through Southeast waters in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer.
Thank you for stepping up. I just have a question I am asking every single person before me on boards and commissions, and the chair knows what the question is. If Lucas is listening, you can answer early. Only because of things we've seen in the past, my question is fairly generic, but what I would like to know, sir, is just for the record, if you could just provide the public an assurance that there is not, and I use this term lightly, skeletons in the closet, you know, arrests, convictions, other things that might come back that would come out if somebody was to investigate your background, that we would find by doing our due diligence, we would want to know about ahead of time. And so while I anticipate the answer is no, I just want to ask this question to feel like we're doing the right thing for those folks that will have some authority as they're appointed to boards and commissions. And if you could just let the committee know whether there are things we should be concerned about or, in fact, you have a good clean record with no skeletons, I would appreciate the answer. Thank you very much.
Senator Schauer, through the chair, I have no issues. I think you can feel rest assured that you won't find my name showing up anywhere.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harris. At this time, we're going to go ahead and move on to Mr. Lucas Hassenbank. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and speak to your qualifications for this board. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me this afternoon. And yeah, my name is Luke Hassenbank. I am president of Alaska Maritime Agencies based out of Anchorage here. I've been working here for this company for 18 years, which has been my entire time here in Alaska. I moved up here after finishing grad school at the University of South Dakota, where I'm from, with a master's in business. I came up here one summer before, where I lived in spent a summer in Homer, Alaska, living on the spit and working on a commercial gill netter and working at a sport fish processing plant. So fell in love with Alaska, and that's how I ended up here. What we do at Alaska Maritime Agencies is we're ship agents, and basically what that is, we're the shore or U.S.-based representative of foreign ship owners, foreign flag ships such as the tankers, cargo ships that come up here, also all of the crews which we run with our partners down in Southeast. We handle every cruise ship that comes into Alaska, so we're basically the direct interface with all the ship owners and ships prior to their arrival into Alaska. We're ensuring that they're following all the state and federal regulations and along with the pilot regulations. So we're communicating with the ship, passing that on to pilots. So we have a direct working relationship with the pilot associations here in Alaska. So I've got a a pretty good working relationship with the pilots up here during my whole 18 years, specifically the Southwest pilots and the Western Alaska pilots, AMP. On top of that, I've also served on the Cook Inlet Harbor Safety Committee. I've done that for about 3 or 4 years as the role of port agent. And I'm also represent the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce for on the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Awareness Council, which was created after the Oil Pollution Act in 1990. That is basically the watchdog for the safe transfer of oil products through Prince William Sound. What else? I've actually been attending pilot board meetings well over a decade now. So I'm very familiar with what goes on there. The reason why I want to serve on this is not only is it important for my company, but also as a citizen of Alaska or a resident of Alaska, of ensuring the protection of Alaskan waters and all the people who operate in. So I take that very seriously. And I believe my experience over these last 18 years and my working relationship with the pilots, along with knowing all the regulations and requirements that that foreign tankers and cargo ships and crews require, I feel like I'd be a really good fit on the board. And to answer the question I heard earlier, clean arrest, no arrest, speeding tickets, no outlandish social media posts outside of an Instagram, just posting pictures of all the circus of animals I have at my house.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hassenbeck, for anticipating the committee's request. Senator Michicki, do you have a question?
I do. I have a statement first. I should, for full disclosure, I happen to be the president of the Cook Inlet Harbor Safety Committee, on which Mr. Hassenbeck serves as an agent representative. I don't believe it's a direct conflict, but I thought you should all know that. And the question I have for you, Luke, is which seat, and do you feel like the lack of technical pilotage background has any impediment on your service on the board?
Yeah, so the seat I'm being appointed for is the industry agent representative, which I feel I accurately represent. And yeah, I am not a mariner, I do not have pilotage expertise or technical know-how. However, I do have a 18 years of experience of bringing tankers and vessels in, and an understanding of all the requirements that that pilotage requires under the federal regulations, and also just a good working knowledge of what it takes to bring ships in, not just the basics, but also when it comes to winter operating guidelines, where our company's role is important on providing all vessels that are coming into Cook Inlet, per se, like before, during these winter operating guidelines, and we're providing them all the information, technical information that they need to be prepared with prior to transiting up Cook Inlet during ice rules. That is basically a whole bunch of information or compiled between pilots, Coast Guard, local stakeholders, and we provide that to ships, ensure that they have a basic understanding of what they're expected to adhere to coming up here. So we've got a good working knowledge of what the pilots are working with up here in Alaska, basically because we talk to them, we communicate to them. Ships have a question prior to coming, we're passing that info back to the pilots for their advice and giving it back to the ship. So a lot of the stuff that we don't know, like mariner-wise, we make up for, and just a lot of communications between the vessels and the vessel operators and the pilots themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Luke.
All right. Any other questions? All righty. I think we're in good shape here. So, for the record, we will be opening public testimony on these two appointments. Anybody in the room who wishes to testify? And anybody online? Seeing none, we will close public testimony on our two commission board appointments. All right, Senator Schauer, do we have a motion to move the appointments forward?
I do, sir. Mr. Chairman, I move the appointment of Richard Harris and Lucas Hosenbank to the Board of Marine Pilots be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. This does not reflect an attempt by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions.
All righty. Seeing no objection, the appointment committee report moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to finish out the paperwork. Okay, Mr. Harris, Mr. Hosenbank, if you're still online, we appreciate your patience. You probably know more about the DMV than you ever wanted to by now. But having no other business before the committee today, that concludes our meeting. Next meeting is Tuesday, March 9th, again at 1:30 back here in the Belts Room. We will be revisiting SB 74, the General Obligation Bonds Bill for the State Infrastructure Projects. With that, we will be adjourned at 2:55 p.m.